Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am a thousand winds that blow. I am the diamond glints in the snow. I am the sun on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn rain. When you awaken in the morning's hush, I am the sweet uplifting rush of quiet birds in circle flight. I am the soft stars that shine at night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die. Mary Elizabeth Fry.
I'm Alan Brill, and this is Brilliant, a podcast from the mind of Brill. But warning,
it's dark out.
A special thanks to my god-grandson Emmett there for lending his voice talents at the intro. Good job, buddy. You nailed it. And also, while I'm giving shout-outs to Joy3111, who I gave a basically what amounted to a stick figure drawing of what I thought my logo should look like, and she really made it come to life. Thank you very much, Joy3111. Well, gang, I recently celebrated my 27th wedding anniversary, and in honor of this milestone, I dug into the old 40 files to find two of our favorite couples here at the Brilla Cobber Studios. Now, this is reported by the Daily Star on December 9th, 1993. Alain and Claudine Dubeux of Chabot, France, were both rushed to the hospital with severe stomach pains. It turns out they had each been secretly adding arsenic to the other's drinks for months. Upon investigation, police discovered they had taken massive insurance policies out on the other. It's kind of hard to get mad, right? Like, you tried to kill me. Like, yeah, well, I mean, you tried to kill me too. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Let's go get lunch. And on March 18th, 1994, The Sun reported that in a remote canyon in Nebraska, 23-year-old woman slashed her boyfriend's throat. He then wrestled the knife away from her and slashed her throat. They then just crawled back to their van, smoked some dope, and waited to die. A passing logger found them stoned and bleeding and rushed into the hospital in Brewer, where the aptly named Sheriff Jim Weed intended to issue assault charges, because this is not their first domestic dispute. I don't know, they sound like a fun couple to me, rooting for those crazy kids. This week on Brilliant, we're going to look at funerary customs in America, how we got to where we are, with an eye towards where we might be headed in the future, and our treatment in honor of our dead. And in order to see how we got to where we are today, we're going to go back to the 6th century. The Catholic Church decreed that burials must be performed only in consecrated churchyard or cathedral grounds. It's all about location, location, location. The dead were buried without coffin, without any eye towards preservation, anything. Basically, just dug a hole, put your carcass in there long enough for the worms and the maggots and the critters to go about their grisly job. And then your bones were removed to make room for the new arrivals who are always coming in. And your bones were then placed in a charnel house. A charnel house was just a big shed to store bones in. It keep you on consecrated grounds, but you could fit more in there. And actually, in some parts of Europe, they still use charnel houses. So not much pomp, not much circumstance. Really pretty utilitarian the way they handled things back then. Now, the rise of Protestantism and the creation of the Church of England by King Henry VIII, IMIM, it played a major role in the transformation of European burials. See, the new church, it barred the English elite from just buying indulgences, so now they needed a new get-out-of-hell-free card. And the graveyard is the place where the living interface with the hereafter. That's your final transition, so it's here they decided to stake their claim for heaven. Now, they had these ornate funeral processions that was basically an advertisement of their good deeds here on earth to the powers that might be watching from on high. And they used gravestones so that their memory, but more importantly, the status of the well-to-do, it could be preserved. They began to pay more attention to the preservation of their bodies to make it, you know, a little bit easier when the rapture came, which meant that they started to use coffins that became more prevalent. And now the customs of the rich, they slowly trickled down to the average man. And by the early 17th century, no English burial was considered proper unless it included a coffin. So that's when coffins really start to come on the scene. So now you got grave markers, you got coffins, you got people concerned with their preservation, and all this is well and good, but you still had to be buried in a consecrated churchyard or in a cathedral. So by the late 1700s, King Louis the 16th, he had a grave problem. See what I did there? Anyway, Paris's burial grounds had just become so full that people's remains started spilling out. During that era, the French in particular, and just the Europeans in general, they weren't very sentimental about their loved ones' remains so long as they were placed on sacred ground. Again, location, location, location. Now, the rich folk, in order to save a couple of steps on the unwashed masses, they would pay extra to the church to actually be interred in the church, in the basement, if they had a basement. If they didn't have a basement, they would just pay to be put in the underneath the floorboards. Now, you cannot cover up the stench of that many decaying corpses in that small of a space. You ever had a mouse die in your wall? Yeah, well, it's that times a million. The poor folk, they were relegated to still being interred in the churchyard, and this basically turned burial grounds into landfills. As we said before, gravediggers would just chuck the bodies in the mass pits, and after adequate decomposition, they would remove the bones to a charnel house and repeat. And in the name of efficiency, sometimes they didn't even dig holes. They just stacked the bodies on top of one another above ground. So on hot summer days, the dead created a gelatinous runoff, and just the smell would overpower the surrounding neighborhoods. People would claim that the gases produced by the decomposing bodies, they would actually snuff out candles and change the color of clothes that it came in contact with. This is a real problem. And in 1780, the spring in Paris came in with just a series of devastating torrential downpours that really softened up the ground, and an avalanche of dead from the Holy Innocents graveyard came bursting through a neighbor's cellar, just filling it up with these carcasses. So King Louis the 16th, he responded by, he banned all further burials within city limits, and 6 years later in 1786, an edict was issued ordering the removal of all human remains and the church building itself to be destroyed. Now, the removal was just incredibly efficient. Night after night, aptly named skeleton crews, removed the corpses and carriages covered by black sheets. Chanting priests chilled the carriages, burning incense, and the remains' final destination was this vast network of limestone tunnels beneath the city, which of course became known as the Paris Catacombs. Usable fat from the still decaying bodies was turned into soap and candle wax while fires burned constantly to try and purify the air. When Napoleon came into power in 1799, he ordered 4 new cemeteries to be constructed on the outskirts of the city, each marking a different point of the compass. And in the early 1800s, cities in the United States were dealing with the same problem of overcrowded graveyards. So burial customs here inevitably changed. There's a lot of meat on the bone, so to say. There's a lot of left to say here. But I'm starting to go down the road to the evolution of cemeteries and graveyards, and that I'm saving for a future episode I'm going to do on boneyards. Tonight, I'm talking about our funerary customs. Now, death, it used to be a private thing, handled by family members. They would wash and prepare the body for burial. The remains of their loved one would be displayed in a front parlor known as a death room, and mourners would visit the home and pay respects. Mirrors were covered and windows were opened ostensibly so that the spirit of the individual would not be trapped in the house, but practically speaking, you'd open the windows because of the smell, right? Anyway, a local carpenter would construct a simple wooden coffin, and within 48 hours, the body would be carried by friends and family to the local graveyard. So what precipitated the change from taking care of our dead ourselves to outsourcing it to funeral homes? Well, practicality, of course, as we've seen, has dictated everything else. Well, that and, you know, the American Civil War. 24-year-old Colonel Elmer Ellsworth would change everything. He was the first Union officer killed in the American Civil War. In May of 1861, he climbed to the roof of an inn in just newly Union-occupied Virginia to remove a Confederate flag. Now, while climbing down from said task, the innkeeper shot and killed him dead. Now, news of this killing just spread across the nation, and a mournful but opportunistic Lincoln used the loss to stoke public support for the war. He ordered the body to lay in state at the White House, then to be transported with much fanfare for viewing at Ellsworth's home city in New York, stopping along the way so people could view the body, sort of a tour of the East Coast, I guess. At this time, a surgeon named Thomas Holmes had been experimenting with embalming cadavers to preserve them for medical research. At this point in American history, bodies weren't embalmed, they were just buried as quickly as possible, and Holmes offered his services to President Lincoln to preserve the body of Elmer for the tour, and Lincoln accepted. By all accounts, the embalming was a success. Soon, families began to want to bring the bodies of their fallen heroes home for burial, and President Lincoln commissioned Holmes to teach and train a legion of embalming surgeons. They set up embalming stations for the Union dead, and the government paid embalmers a $30 fee to preserve an enlisted soldier and $80 for an officer to get the Ellsworth treatment. And a flash embalming industry emerged with freelance embalmers of various skills and scruples, stalking the battlefields even before engagements had ended. They would set up tents and pre-charge some of the soldiers to be first in line should their services be needed. And some of these guys, they would even embalm the bodies without the family's permission, and then basically hold the bodies hostage until their fees were paid by helpless loved ones. Holmes, the rock star embalmist, he even opened a pair of shops in Washington, D.C., where he would hang the preserved bodies of unknown soldiers in the front window to display his skill and his handiwork. And this is according to the Museum of Civil War Medicine. Talk about a grisly window display. Yikers. Now, when the hostilities ended, there was still this industry of full-service professionals that had arisen to build and sell coffins and embalm and prepare the dead, and they had to find new customers somewhere in order to stay in business, and business was very good. So undertakers began to promote the idea that all people should be embalmed after death. This way, mourners could come from greater distances to view the body. And they established parlors outside of the home where funerals could be held, so a corpse wouldn't have to sit idly in the family's death room stinking up the joint. They changed the name and the look of the coffin. Coffin comes from the old French word coffin, meaning basket. And, okay, the coffins are the hexagonally shaped ones that are wider at the shoulders and narrower at the head and feet, like you see in the Westerns or the old-timey vampire movies. They changed that to casket, which are just rectangular shape, and they no longer reminded people of the human body that they contain. Casket arose in England in the 1600s to refer to a jewelry box until the 19th century American funeral industry appropriated it. And in 1895, the name undertaker was changed to mortician. And finally, it morphed to the term we use today, funeral director. Almost overnight, the act of displaying a loved one at home was out. In a 1910 Ladies' Home Journal article, they recommended that people start calling the old death room in their home by a new and more pleasant-sounding name, the living room. And that, in the proverbial nutshell, is the evolution of funerary customs in America and how we have gotten to where we are today. But of course, all things continue to evolve and to grow and to change, and this is now the first time in American history that more people are choosing to be cremated than buried. And naturally, all this has got me thinking about my own funeral when I shuffle off this mortal coil, and it's certainly an uncomfortable and never a pleasant topic to think about, but it is an important one, and I had a few questions. So I went to my local funeral director, and he was kind enough to answer me. Number one, I wanted to know, could you still be buried in your backyard? Turns out, no, you cannot. In order to establish a cemetery, the land must be deeded to the county and a trust fund set up to pay for future maintenance. Another thing is, I don't want to be embalmed. I'd rather be broken down and my nutrients returned to the earth, rather than just become a bag of poison in the ground, just a toxic thing, not good for the world that sprung me. Now, I get it if the preservation means something to you, and I totally get that. I'm just saying it's not for me, so I wonder, do people still have to be embalmed? The answer is no, do not have to be embalmed unless there's a viewing. Which brings me to another way that our burial customs are once again changing, with the popularity growing now of the green burial. Now, what is a green burial? Well, here are a few characteristics. It forgoes toxic embalming. It does away with vaults. It chooses biodegradable containers, caskets, shrouds, and urns. It discontinues the use of herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers, and encourages sustainable management practices. You may use GPS units or non-native stone markers to mark grave sites. And, of course, it'll support land conservation efforts. Totally down with having a headstone still. I mean, you can do the GPS thing, too, if you want. But, I want a little headstone there to memorialize my life and give people something to visit. Or a tree. That'd be cool. That's a thing you can do now, too, in some cemeteries. And all this goes to the value of pre-planning, of choosing all this beforehand. So, you get what you want, and also it takes a lot of stress off your loved ones. Don't wait to die to plan your funeral. Go ahead and get it out beforehand. A lot of times you can pay on installments, and that defrays the cost on your loved ones, and the decision making that they have to make on, one of the worst days of their lives. And what we can do to make it easier for those who survive us is really the most important thing. And there you go. There you have it, folks. The bulk of the material I got for the funerary customs portion of this show was from the book Over My Dead Body, Unearthing the Hidden History of America's Cemeteries by Greg Melville. And this book is fantastic. He not only gives you, the background on cemeteries, graveyards, funeral customs, but he explores these graveyards, and in doing so, reveals what they indicate about American history, and our history is told through these graveyards. It is an absolutely fantastic book. You can get it on Amazon. I couldn't more highly recommend it. One of my tops. Check it out, please.
And we have Charlie calling in from the Sunflower State of Kansas with a story to share for us tonight. Welcome to the show, Charlie.
Thank you for having me.
A pleasure.
So, yeah, what kind of question do you have for me? I mean, I think
I heard you had a ghostly experience in a building that was once a funeral parlor.
Yeah, so let me start to give the groundwork for it. So I work for a federal agency, and I go to a lot of small towns. I mean, there's like these rural communities that's been around, forever. I mean, some of these towns are just basically, going down to like 50 population of that sort. But I remember when I was in Florida, this is one of the towns that I was helping with the CFO when we were in the town hall. You know, they usually close around 5, 6 and different part and segment. So it's pretty much closed. I was just helping do some help the CFO do some documents and stuff like that, just, fill out documents. And I was just, and she was running back and forth in her office doing her thing, and I was just filling out paperwork. And you know, it was getting pretty quiet, and then I noticed like there was some sort of feeling that someone was looking at me or observing me, you know. And I noticed that for a little bit, and I just kept minding my own business and doing it. And you know, then and when I started, the CFO actually came, and that's one of the couple of days that I've done it, you know, going back and forth, because it's a process, you know, with bureaucracy. So, and when I was walking out with the CFO, and I was asking, I was like, hey, you know, like, I was feeling a little weird. It's the kind of, I'm not saying just because of the lights are out and there's no one in the town hall. It's just, you know, it's just like a weird feeling of someone observing and then looking at. And then she was nonchalantly just say, oh, this used to be a funeral parlor. And,
yeah, you know, just, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And,
yeah. Dwayne's Haunted, sure.
And it's like one of the oldest town in the U.S. incorporated. And, yeah, so I was kind of freaked out. And then it's an ease. And then I kind of explained everything, but. Yeah, like from then on, I would never stay late there.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I love, she's just like, oh yeah, Joint's haunted, man. I also like picturing just the ghost, because he's bored. He's got nothing to do. It's a small town, just like looking over your shoulder, like, yeah, you got to carry the one there, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's anything malicious. Like, I don't feel like it's malicious. It was just a weird feeling. You know, sometimes like the hair on your neck starts standing out, kind of deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So, but yeah, so I mean, I go to a lot of small towns and rural communities. So, I mean, every town has its own charm and history and of that sort. You know, I mean, I go to towns that are just used to be like a junction railroad town, and it's just, you know, just dying out. But this one specifically, I remember. I mean,
a memorable event for sure.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that she showed me like the all the newspaper clipping, and they had it on the wall and saying, and then it was like, yeah, this used to be a funeral parlor. Like it was standing out there and stuff like that. But there's a lot of memories that like people throughout the years, you could see those, you know, when you go to a town, right, with those newspaper clippings on the walls and stuff like that, that they frame out.
But, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's just, I don't know how people work there. I mean, I don't think it's a malicious thing. I mean,
yeah, no, it didn't sound like it to me, but yeah, I guess you just get used to it. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, but apparently, like, everyone knows that in the town, so.
Yeah, just like, oh, yeah, yeah, joint's haunted, yeah. Oh, no big deal.
Yeah, so, I don't know. I mean, I don't think I stayed long. This was a while ago, so I don't think I stayed long to, like, ask them about what spooky stories everyone got.
Right.
Sure everyone has one, you know. But, yeah, I mean, so, long story short, I'm not sure if it's too intriguing, but...
Well, I certainly, anything like that is what I think. It's a great story, and I appreciate you sharing it and coming on the show tonight.
Oh, no problem. Like, yeah, any questions you have, but, yeah, I mean, if you have time, just go to these charming little towns.
Okay, folks, it's that time of the show where I advise you that if you have little ears listening, you might want to send them away for a couple of minutes or skip ahead about 4 minutes. This next segment is for adults only. Draw the blinds, dim the lights, and snuggle up with the one you love best, because it's time for Brilliant After Dark. Now, as you can probably guess from that introduction, we're heading over to France for this installment of Brilliant After Dark. There we'll find the monument to one Victor Noir. Noir, whose real name was Ivan Salmon, was a journalist in the mid to late 1800s, and he supported a paper, or he worked for a paper which supported another paper which opposed the local political scheme. Now, this pissed off Pierre Bonaparte, the great nephew of infamous Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte, and he challenged Noir's boss to a duel. Noir was chosen as a second and was sent to see Bonaparte with a message that basically said that his boss wouldn't duel with Napoleon Bonaparte. He would duel with the editor of the opposing paper, but he wouldn't mess with his menials. So upon hearing this, Bonaparte slapped Victor Noir in the face and then shot him dead. So yeah, he shot the messenger. Bonaparte was acquitted of all charges, and the people were roused, and the journalist became a symbol of imperial justice and a martyr for the Republic. Over 100,000 people attended his funeral, and calls for an insurrection were heard. And later that year, Napoleon III was dethroned. Following the establishment of the Third French Republic, Noir's remains were transferred to Père Lachaise Cemetery, where James Dollot was commissioned to create the monument to this martyr, this political and national hero. Dollot, a prominent French artist and sculptor, built a monument to depict Victor Noir laying on the ground as he was after he was murdered. Except he made the statue really well endowed. He put a big old hog leg in those trousers. And somewhere down the line, it became a superstition that if you were to touch this protuberance or various other acts, then you would be more fertile or just have a blissful sex life for a year. And if you look at the pictures of the statue, it is shiny and discolored on the tips of his toes, his crotch, and his mouth, and they are well eroded away. And so if you Google long enough, you'll see that they're not just touching those areas of the body. Now, this is a national monument to a national treasure made by a renowned artist. And the government grew concerned over the fact that it was being eroded away and constructed 4-foot walls around it to keep people out. And the ladies of France were furious. They threw a giant protest. You know, Prime Minister, tear down this wall. And they won. They tore the walls down, and you are now welcome to go rub on the statue whenever you want. And the ladies of France got together and told the government, hey, you have no right to stop us from masturbating on a national treasure. Which, you know, I guess all I have to say to that is, Vive la France!
Tonight on the show, we have Ray, and she has some experiences from her childhood that she's here to share with us.
So, whenever I was younger, I can't recall how old I was. Maybe, I think my mom said 7 or 8, somewhere around in there. My grandma had passed away. We had moved into her house when she was sick, and we took care of her and stuff, and she ended up passing in the home. Well, after she'd passed, I ended up sleeping back where she passed away, and at nighttime, whenever I would lay down and go to sleep, the TV would turn on to Westerns, and then every once in a while, I would see something standing in the corner. It was all a dark, it was a shadow, basically, but you could tell long hair looking at me. Well, my parents kept thinking I would get up in the middle of the night and watch TV, so I ended up getting my TV taken away for watching Westerns that I had no clue about.
Granny getting you in trouble.
Yeah.
Because all little girls like to watch black and white Westerns in the middle of the night, right?
I have no idea.
Did they find out later that...
Yeah. So they ended up plugging the TV in their room, and one night it turned to Westerns out of the blue, and they didn't think I was so crazy then.
Well, hey, thank you very much for sharing these with us, and can't wait to have you back on the program.
You're welcome.
I'd like to take this time to really thank my three guests this evening. Emmett for lending his voice talents there in the intro. Charlie calling in from the Sunflower State to share his tale of the haunted former funeral parlor. And Ray, with her story of the TV watching ghost of a grandma. It's these kinds of stories that really powers this show. And also, if you're listening to this on YouTube, you can also listen to it on Amazon Music, Spotify, Apple Music, most of your major podcast platforms. So check me out there if it's more convenient. If you're watching on YouTube, go ahead and give me a like and subscribe. That way you don't miss any of these awesome podcasts when they drop. And you know what, folks? I think you spent enough time in my noggin for 1 week. So as you exit these dark corridors of my mind, I would leave you with this warning. Be careful, because it can get dark out there.